The following tone is a reference tone, recorded at our operating level.
And welcome back to episode 13, take 2 of Squat Cobbler. I am Mike at Official Pagan, and joining me is...
Hi, everybody. I'm Kelly at K-E-L-L-Y-T-H-U-L on Twitter. And indeed, this will be a second attempt to discuss schools out, since our first attempt had worse than the audio issues you've become used to in Squat Cobbler, because there was like... no audio for parts of it.
I don't want to, at the risk of maybe sounding like some sort of crazy conspiracy theorist, I'm going to say that it's probably some sort of government conspiracy. Tonight just so happens to be the debate, which they know everyone will be watching and not trying to watch us do Squat Cobbler live. So they're trying to hold us back. They don't want people to know our opinion on Schools Out.
The Russians aren't going to have to hack our accounts to find out what we think about Schools Out, because we're gonna tell you again.
Again, right now. We are fighting the power, and we are going to make sure that you, whether you want it or not, are going to know everything you need to know about Schools Out, according to us.
Trusted sources in Alice Cooper sense this year.
All right, so Kelly, what's your sort of overall take on Schools Out?
So overall, I enjoy this album quite a bit. There's a whole chunk of Alice albums here that run in a row that are all tremendously enjoyable. It'd be on the short list if someone is looking to buy some Alice albums. It'd be in the list. It wouldn't be at the very top, but it would be in that early list of items. They, with Killer, had started to get a little more thematic in that the songs weren't really telling a singular storyline, but they all kind of hung together on a theme, and that certainly carries forward into this album, where they start to even dial that up a little bit more. Overall, it's a very enjoyable album. I like it quite a bit. How about you?
Same, pretty much. Not a favorite per se, but definitely a great album. Enjoyable all the way through. There's a few little quibbles that I think we'll both have. Spoiler alert, because I already did this with you. we'll touch on in a few minutes. Before we get to that, though, I do think it's important to mention the packaging on this, because with Killer, you got the calendar with Hung Alice. And why don't you explain to our lovely listeners what you got with the initial vinyl release of Schools Out?
So I didn't purchase the initial release, but I did purchase it as vinyl. And it was in very plain packaging, and there was nothing special about it.
That doesn't sound right, Kelly.
Wait, maybe that's not exactly right. Okay, now that you mention it, it came out like a school desk. So you actually could open the top of the album. It opened like the top of a school desk. There was all sorts of things carved into the top of the school desk, the initials of the various members of the Alice Cooper group. You could look into what one guess is an Alice Cooper band member's school desk and see all the goodies that they had inside of it. And the backside of the album actually folded out, so you could simulate that little section where you'd slide your books in the old school desks as well. So it sat up like an actual school desk.
Which is really cool.
Yeah, it's really cleverly done. But I'm going to guess you're also interested in some of the other packaging that, when it very first came out, not only did you have this amazing kind of desk set up to go forward, but in addition to the plastic shrink wrap, and I believe this was actually under the shrink wrap, were a pair of paper panties that came with the original Schools Out release that somewhere over time they stopped including when you bought it.
Now, I'd read online that had something to do with the paper panties being flammable. That, I'm not sure if that's true or not, but it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, because the whole thing is cardboard, so it's flammable.
Yeah, I think it could pretty much all catch fire, so I'm with you.
Right. I feel like it's all flammable, so maybe it was just too expensive to produce. Now, by the time you had purchased the album, that was no longer a pack-in, correct?
That was no longer a pack-in at that point.
Now, just to go with the school desk theme, so take us back to your school days, the Kelly Tool Catholic school experience. If we had looked into your desk, what would we find in Kelly Tool's desk?
Nothing exciting. For sure. So I, as you mentioned, I had the opportunity to have a Catholic grade school education. So there was a bit of rigor around what might happen to be in those desks and some ongoing evaluations on the tidiness of that desk. So what you would find when you'd open my desk is a complete mess, which was just stuff was all over the place, much to the disappointment of the sisters who were running the institution, and they expressed that dismay. Outside of the fact that I was already possessed by the devil because I was left-handed, and they were desperately trying to stop me from being left-handed.
You know, I actually, just to get off on a tangent that we didn't do in the original take of this, I used to be left-handed and now I'm right-handed, not because they forced me to do it in school, although I did go to Catholic school. At the time when you learn to write, I shattered my collarbone, so I had to start doing everything with our right hand, and now at 34 I'm right-handed.
You didn't want to slide back there? Are you ambidextrous? Can you write both ways? Or are you really a pure right-hander now?
Just pure right-hander now, pretty much, because I just started doing everything with my right hand. It is weird, though. So years later, I broke my right hand, and I had to start doing stuff with my left hand, and it was kind of difficult. And what sucked is, like, just as I kind of got into the swing of doing things left-handed again, my hand was healed, and I went right back to doing the right-handed stuff. What's interesting, and I never noticed this before, but a couple people have pointed it out to me, I do still do things with my left hand. Things that don't require a lot of, like, technical precision, I tend to lead with my left hand on that. But stuff like writing and things like that where I need to be more precise, I'll do that with my right hand.
And I know you're a big sports guy, so when you're...
Absolutely.
When you're playing squash, I assume you swing the squash racket with the right hand.
That's a really interesting question because I have such limited experience in sports. I don't actually know which hand I would use for any sport. I don't know if I would lean right or left-handed, to be honest with you.
Well, so we can go a different way here. So let's say you had an axe and you were looking to put it through someone's head.
Okay, which, so I'm so glad you said this because this is 100% real and it's pretty cool. This week, I believe Tuesday night, we're recording this on a Sunday evening. This will all be over by the time our listeners hear this, but this upcoming Tuesday, I am going to an axe throwing demonstration where they will teach me to throw an axe.
So we'll see. So I'm going to guess you're going to probably be throwing that with your right. So we will discover whether you are from a sports standpoint, right or left-handed. So
I don't know
really...
if that's sports so much as murder training, but I'm in either way.
I'm not sure who thinks it's a really good idea to train you to throw an axe. I mean, that would not be something I'd have on the short list.
So interestingly enough, I do know how to throw knives. This is, I guess, just the natural progression of that. When I was a kid, my grandfather taught me how to throw knives. And I mean, when I say kid, I was like 6 or 7 years old when he taught me how to do it. So,
At neighbors, a noisy dog?
It was like the tree in the backyard. I mean, we didn't live in like a rural area. This is like the city. So it did cause a little bit of an stir among some of the neighbors when this went down. But, you know, I was pretty good at it. So they were fine once they realized they weren't going to get hit with a stray knife. Everybody seemed kind of cool with it. I don't know if that would fly today so much, though.
If you were to give any of the squatties out there just your kind of top knife-throwing tip as you gained expertise there, is there like one if someone's looking to possibly at night, because you may not want the neighbors to see it, practice some knife-throwing? Is there an early tip? Is the equipment important? Is it more important to get the right knife or get the right technique?
It's a little bit of both, especially if you're starting, though. The right knife is more important. The knife has to be balanced. That's really the trick. A tip, and this sounds really obvious until you cut yourself really badly, be very careful pulling the knives back out of whatever you're throwing them into. Most people, myself included, when they don't know what they're doing, tend to grab towards the blade and pull, and that's how you cut your hand.
That'll do it.
All right, so I'm sorry to get off on that little bit of a tangent. I want to get back to the desk, though. So I, too, had a messy desk. I was a Catholic school child as well. I had a very messy desk. In fact, one of the lay teachers, I want to say around fourth grade, one of the lay teachers got so frustrated with the state of my desk. She asked me to stand up. She picked up my desk and threw it at the chalkboard. It hit the chalkboard. I don't know if it hit it so hard. I don't know how hard chalkboard material is. So I don't know if it's that she threw it that hard or maybe it's not as sturdy as I believed it to be as a child, but she broke a piece of the chalkboard throwing my desk at it.
And blamed you, I'm sure.
She just kind of stormed out. I was blamed for a lot of things as a kid, though. And to be fair, like 50% of them I did do. I was a shitty kid. But I was also blamed for a lot of stuff I didn't do just based on the fact that I was a bad kid.
Seems like a reasonable cause for profiling to me.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny because I was talking with somebody recently. We were talking about like getting stopped by police and stuff when you're teenagers and getting harassed about whether or not you're drinking and stuff like that. And I was like, yeah, I used to get stopped by cops all the time. I mean, in their defense, 90% of the time I was breaking the law. So
it was a good stop.
Yeah. Really, most of the time they were dead on. But still, at that time, I felt, you know, really like I was being oppressed. Persecuted. Yeah. I was definitely oppressed and persecuted, even though most of the time I was actually breaking the law.
Yeah, there's such a fine line between oppression and being held accountable for your actions.
when you're an idiot teenager, everything feels like oppression. You don't realize you're the asshole most of the time.
Except if there happen to be any teen listeners to Squat Cobber.
Right, you guys are obviously awesome. Geniuses, yeah.
Clearly.
Now, getting back to your desk, and of course, tying it back to the album. So had we looked inside your desk, Kelly, would we have found panties, paper, or otherwise?
So no, you would not. I am what they call in the scientific community a late bloomer. And so the charming, debonair gentleman that you see today was not present until fairly late in life. There was not much opportunity for me to secure such items during the grade school / high school. And then high school, you didn't have a dedicated desk anyway. But I didn't have a storage issue. It wasn't a problem for me from there. However, since you asked the question, had we gone into, we'd stepped around the broken chalkboard and made our way back to your desk, what would we have found? Would we have found panties there, paper or otherwise?
Not in fourth grade, but definitely later than that, yes. There was one incident in particular, and you kind of heard this story already, but for our listeners, this is brand new. So there was my parents were divorced when I was very young. So I was shuffled back and forth between my parents until I became an emancipated minor at 16. But prior to that, I was shuffled back and forth. And one night I was at my father's house and he was out for the evening and I had a lady friend classmate over and we were doing some very vigorous, study work. So that we would be prepared for school come Monday morning, obviously. And she wore this bright neon green thong to help her study and retain the information that we were.
That is the most retainable color, I believe. I think that's.
Yes, it is. I'm pretty sure I saw that that might be being spoken of at the political debate right now, the presidential debate, as far as the future of our education system resting upon green thongs.
However, if either one of the combatants this evening is sporting a bright neon green thong, I don't want to know it, and I never want to see it.
Don't want to know it, never want to see it. And to be honest with you, I'm not sure which one would be worse to see in the green thong.
I'm going to avoid trying to picture it.
So anyway, my father was a very conservative, Christian, straight-laced kind of guy. So he was not aware of these study sessions that were going on. As far as he was aware, it was a study session that was going on. And so when we left that evening, I headed over to my mother's house and I got a call from my young tutor who was with me. And she informed me that she had forgotten something at my father's house. And I was like, oh, that's cool. I'll just grab it after school or whatever and give it to you, thinking it was like a necklace or an earring or something like that. And she goes, no, I forgot something green at your father's house. And I felt like all of my insides were ripped out in one swoop. It was a scary, scary moment for me.
Because you weren't going to be able to pull off, no, those are mine, right?
Right, yeah, there was no way. Okay. And maybe if it was just a green thong, but it was clearly not my size either. There was just no way that this was going to fly. So the next morning we got there and I got there very, very early thinking I brought her with me and I thought we could sneak in, get them and get back out before anyone was the wiser. Of course, that wasn't the case. Almost made it, got into the house, got all the way upstairs. It was a 3-story home, so that wasn't as easy a task as you would think. Get up to the 3rd floor, get them. We make our way all the way back down and sure enough, there's my dad waiting by the door. He heard us come in. And he starts questioning what's going on. So I was like, oh, well, she forgot something. And he's like, what did you forget? And luckily, she was much more intelligent than I am. And she had taken off one of her earrings in case we got caught so that she could present the earring in her hand and say that that's what she had lost. So that worked out for me really well. Later in the school year, she had worn those same study appropriate underwear to school and I was able to claim them as my own and take those with me. So I did, in fact, have underwear in my desk at one point.
And now over the mantle at the Belinsky household.
Yes.
Next to the ram head.
Sometimes they're on the ram head.
That's a look.
So I feel like that brings us actually to our first song on the album, now that we've thoroughly discussed the packaging.
Yes, covered it in great detail. It's worth a shot. I tried to go with, there's nothing special about it.
You did try to get around it because you knew it was coming. So the first track on the album, of course, the title song, School's Out. What are your thoughts on this, Kelly?
So obviously, it's the song that the vast majority of people associate with Alice Cooper. I'm going to guess it was his biggest hit. I don't know if it went to number one or not, but it is. You know, it's not a novelty song, but it's definitely a song that at the end of every school year gets put into rotation and people, you know, speak about it then. And they connect it with Alice. If you talk to someone who doesn't know Alice much at all, they go, oh, yeah, School's Out, because they have that connection. And it's got elements that are a lot of things that make Alice stuff great. Some really good guitar hooks. And, you know, you can't mistake it when it starts off. You know, you're going into School's Out and it's some pretty nice guitar riffs going on. Some clever work with the lyrics, and, you know, where he's in kind of self-aware lyrics where it's the lyrics don't rhyme, and he brings that up in the chorus or prior to the chorus in terms of that. And it's kind of a fun thing. And it actually, and I'm not going to be able to get the name of the group right, because this was back in the early, I'm going to say 50s. There was a group of folks that did some movies, the Berksley Boys or something like that. I can't remember what, but actually School's Out actually came from, it was like kind of a, yeah, mister, School's Out, kind of a gangstery kind of thing. So that's actually where it came from as far as the term. But I like the song. It is, and maybe it's, I find a lot of his other stuff richer, and as we go through this album in particular, there's songs I like better than School's Out. I certainly enjoy hearing it anytime I do. You hear it a lot, and it's usually the ending song of most concerts, as you might expect. I'm a fan of it. I don't really have any complaints about the song. It's good guitar rock. It's fun. It's just not my favorite Alice Cooper song.
Yeah, this song really kind of falls into the same category as 18 does for me, where it's a fine song. I enjoy hearing the song. It's definitely one of the most recognizable. Along with 18, it's probably the song most people associate with Alice Cooper if they're just casual listeners. I just don't think it's one of the strongest songs. I love the song. It's just not one of the strongest songs by the band. And somebody who's a little bit more of a dedicated fan like we are is just going to have so many favorites and such a familiarity with the catalog that I think these big hits like this, while we enjoy them, aren't going to resonate the same way that the album tracks like Halo of Flies, for example, would.
I'd agree. And then, in fact, there's a couple tracks, at least one track on here that I think overshadows it significantly. We'll get to that before we go through. But it's good. It certainly sets the theme. It's a good, strong start. Definitely know you're going to be hearing about school in this, and it's certainly something that they've become recognized for.
Absolutely. And next up we have Looney Tune. What are your thoughts on this, sir?
So this is a pretty diverse album in terms of sound. And I guess if you go back, there's a lot of diversity in Love It to Death, a decent amount in Killer as well. This goes into a couple different places where not every song is kind of line them up rock and roll. This is one of them that kind of, you know, second track on the album, and he already starts to depart kind of from kind of straightforward three chord hammer and rock and roll. Kind of serpentine. It is revisiting a little bit of Alice as the cracked narrator, not necessarily being all there and being a little crazy. It's an enjoyable song. It is kind of different, you know, and there's a lot in this album of some decent instrumentality and some different instruments show up in this than have been in previous Alice albums or featured more heavily, at least. I enjoy it. I probably enjoy kind of the picture painted by the lyrics a little bit more than the actual song construction itself, but I like both.
Yeah, pretty much the same here. And you touched on something that's important to note. Not only is the instrumentation on this album strong, particularly for me, the guitar and bass work on this really stands out in a different way than it had on the previous couple of records. And you hear some stuff that really wasn't a major part of their sound before on this record, particularly keyboards really being brought to the forefront rather than just being used as something to accent. And we also get a lot of horns and stuff on this record that we haven't heard up until this point. Which brings us to our next song,
Yes,
speaking of things you might not expect to hear. So we have Gutter Cats versus the Jets. Explain this to our listeners, sir.
So it's a pretty awesome song, first of all. But you want to be Team Gutter Cat, gang, because Team Gutter Cat is the Alice Cooper group. And they're cool. And the Jets, yes, they're those Jets. They're the West Side Story Jets. And they sing some of the West Side Story, "When you're a Jet all the way" stuff in here. So you get the front part of the song, which is establishing the Gutter Cat gang, which is Alice's gang, who then inexplicably runs into the Broadway Jets gang, who's kind of singing in their Broadway way, and they have a clash. But this to me is a cool song. This is, you got Alice in one of his nicer vocal executions, really kind of spitting out the lyrics on there in terms of talking about the gang and these types of things. And then, you know, just some eloquent things about romance, because, you know, he talks about a young lady that's drawn his attention, and because he's a gutter cat, you know, he frames it in those terms. He talks about, "She made my eyes bug out, my tail stand up, and I ain't even in heat for a month," which I thought, you know, is almost a Valentine. It's kind of very nice that way.
I mean, if I was going to write my own wedding vows, it would be hard not to quote that directly.
What a missed opportunity that was.
You know,
why more people haven't used those?
If you want to renew your vows with Mrs. Toole, it just so happens you know not one but two ministers.
That's right. Well, I'm a minister. I don't have the certificate because you got to pay money for that. But I got the email back saying I'm in.
There you go. See, you're ordained. Now you just need to make some Reverend Kelly merchandise and you don't have to pay taxes on it, I heard. I wouldn't know anything about that, of course. So my take on this song, this is actually surprisingly not the first time, even up until this point in the Alice Cooper catalog, that we've heard them sort of delve into that Broadway musical end of the pool. I do think, though, that the little thing they did in Halo of Flies with the Sound of Music sort of callback in there was a little bit more effective than the West Side Story element of this. But the first part of the song, the Gutter Cats part of the song, Alice's delivery is just so good that it makes the song for me.
Yeah, it's a great, I'd agree completely. And it's particularly the front part of the song is super fun. There's a couple kind of moments through this. This is a very good album, but as you contrast it to some of the previous works and actually some of the works that are coming up, you know, there's just a couple times where it was kind of making some of the safe calls in a very, I don't want to call it unimaginative, but it was kind of a straight read on, oh, you got the Gutter Cats and so you're going to do the Jets. And it was more of a straight read of it, whereas Halo of Flies and pulling in a little Sound of Music kind of call in, it was a little more clever, I think. So, but it's still, this is one of the best songs on this album, I think. It's really fun. And it kind of extends, you know, on the track listing, there's another song that pops up called Street Fight, but right. It's really just the extension of the Gutter Cats and the Jets meeting up, and they have a street fight, which was reenacted on stage during the stage show to support this album.
Like you said, it's really not, the Street Fight track really isn't a song. It just feels like a little ending to Gutter Cats versus the Jets that got its own track, which I wonder if it was just to make the album appear a little weightier than it probably was, which was a trick that Black Sabbath used to use. If you look at the early pressings, and some of the reissues do it as well, but it's not on all of them. Their first few albums, which are really only like six or seven songs a piece because of the length of the tracks, they would name the intros of the songs to make it look like there were more songs on the album than there actually were as a selling point for the album. So I kind of feel like, you know, because there's only nine tracks on this and two of them aren't really songs, but extensions of the songs that came before them, that it was something to make it look like there was maybe a little more material on here than there actually is. Also, too, this being a really short track, it's interesting to kind of note about this album. Up until this point, we've had track lengths that are really all over the place. There's no like crazy, you know, 8 or 9 minute epics on this album. It's a little bit more calculated in that 3 and 4 minute song range, a little bit more uniform in that sense. And this is where, to me, this album isn't quite as good as Love It to Death or Killer, only because I feel like in the Alice Cooper world, it's a little bit more formulaic than those albums are.
I'd see that, and you know, and it's we're kind of picking at little nits on it, because overall, this is a really great album. But in kind of comparing and contrasting, It is a little more calculated. It is a little more formulaic in a couple points, not as creative as some of the thinking was before or in certainly the next album we'll talk about. But it's still good stuff. But yeah, I do think, you know, and since I can see in the future, I think we'll probably a little later kind of point to maybe here's a second instance of where there's two tracks that maybe you could argue are one, but that would put, you know, this School's Out comes out with a 9-track listing on iTunes or anywhere else you go. But I think if you took a pretty hard look at it, it's a 7-track album.
Yeah, it's really only 7 individual songs, with 2 of them getting broken onto 2 tracks. Yep. So up next, we have Blue Turk. Now, what's your thoughts on this, sir? I think this is definitely one of the more interesting songs on the album.
Yeah, I would agree. And I like it quite a bit. It is unlike anything that we've heard from this group so far. It's jazzier, some great bass stuff. There was, you know, also some decent bass stuff in the, you know, most of Street Fight was sound effects, but there was some kind of cool bass stuff going on with it too. That carries forward a different kind of bass, but still some pretty great bass in Blue Turk. Also a much first time you get kind of a brass section, saxophone, some other stuff going on, much more heavily present here than you've really ever kind of heard on Alice Cooper album. Again, as any Cooper release has, there's all these kind of magical lyrical moments towards the tail end of the song, where in the early parts of the song, Alice is the person singing the song is very complimentary. You're so very picturesque, this type of thing. But you get to the end, and instead it's kind of taken a turn, and now it's like, you're so very ordinary, tastes like whiskey on your breath, and earthworms rule your brain. Which is it somewhere? There's a t-shirt in there somewhere, I think.
Absolutely. And correct me if I'm wrong, but this one, listening to it, kind of put me in the same mind in the vocal delivery, not in any other way in the song itself. The vocal delivery reminds me of a couple of parts of Dwight Fry.
I think there are a couple elements in here, and then there's another song where there's a super strong Dwight Fry. But there's I think the frantic part of Dwight Fry shows up a little later in this album, but some of the mid parts of Dwight Fry show up in this song. I'd agree. You get kind of some of that. You get bluesy, jazzy, kind of not meandering, but it's kind of a cool, slow song, but with some great vocal work and some decent lyrics.
Yeah, absolutely. And you brought up an important point as well. So Street Fight, which really isn't its own song, does have a kind of cool bass thing going on. And that continues in a different way into this song. And this is really the first time for the Alice Cooper group that bass was so prominent as it is in these two tracks.
Yeah, that's where I think... So Michael Bruce, people that kind of know the group fairly well, will throw a lot of credit Michael Bruce's way. He was a major songwriting influence. Many of the top hits he had a very integral part to. He's a very competent guitarist. Glenn Buxton, prior to starting to have problems with some of his outside recreational activities, was a really strong guitarist as well. So you had a couple of guitarists people pay attention to. Neil Smith was kind of this weird force of nature to watch on drums, because he's like 6'6" and big long arms and flailing around and doing some of these really unique drum lines that come out of Cooper songs. But you don't hear folks talk much about Dennis Dunaway, the bass player, but he's a pretty good bass player. This album in particular highlights the kind of range of what he can do, and he does a good job.
Absolutely. And up next, we have My Stars. What are your thoughts, sir?
So if this is playing on a CD, and if I've got a CD playing in the car and this comes on, or if I'm listening to it on a iPod, this is a song that on occasion I might hit advance on. that it's not that bad a song, but compared to the, I kind of want to get to the, its biggest problem is that it's before my favorite song. And so I kind of lose patience. Okay, time for me to go to my favorite song. But that's a piece of it. But it's probably on this one my kind of least favorite song on the album. It's not a bad song. It does feature, back to the keyboard thing, it features some pretty cool keyboard stuff going on. And it's a very kind of bombastic, far-reaching song in terms of what it does kind of musically, lyrically. So it's kind of a nice piece of craftsmanship. It's never super resonated with me. And again, it's standing in the way between me and the next song. That's not a good place to be.
So musically, it's probably the strongest song in the album in terms of just the technical precision of it. But I also agree with you, it at the same time might be my least favorite of the seven real songs on the album. It's probably my least favorite. It's very, very indicative of the stuff you hear on mainstream rock and roll records of that time, though. Like, it almost puts you in mind of a Meatloaf type of thing.
Yeah, it's that big kind of high production bombastic in the keyboards. Bob Ezrin, who had begun to do the producing for them, was also, Bob's not a bad keyboard player, and he's been playing it throughout, the starting with Love It to Death. And this one lets him kind of be featured almost as more of a full band member, because he gets a decent amount of time on this song.
The keyboards are much more prominent in this, whereas on Love It to Death and Killer, it's predominantly for effect. Whereas on this, you really get the feeling it's an instrument that's standing alongside the guitars, for better or worse.
I'd agree.
I know you like skipping this song, so do you want to just get right to the next one?
I think we just need to hit forward and go to the next one, which is my favorite song on this album by far. And we've already established on previous shows that Halo of Flies. So you're suspiciously not on record yet, but we may not have come to the Alice Cooper song for you, but we have for me, and that was Halo of Flies. Halo of Flies is my favorite Alice Cooper song, bar none. But Public Animal number 9. On just about every level, gave it a run for its money. It falls a little bit short because of just the awesomeness that is Halo of Flies and the amazing things. But Public Animal number 9, from the title, how can you not be excited about a song called Public Animal number 9? And that kind of playful crisscross of Public Enemy number 1, Public School number this, kind of coming up with Public Animal number 9. It's a great song. And this, when you mentioned Dwight Fry-esque vocal delivery, Public Animal number 9 is sung quite a bit in this song. It's the main part of the chorus, and at the very tail of this song, Alice just repeats it and gets growlier and growlier, to where at the very end, he's just like, Public Animal number 9. It's pretty cool.
In the tradition of the best Alice Cooper songs, just from the title, it kind of grabs you, and then the song itself lives up to that title. It's easily my favorite on this album. I wouldn't say it's my favorite Alice Cooper song, but it's definitely up.
Again, so we already have some wedding vows that we've identified some people could reuse from there. Here are the very kind of opening lyrics of it, which is, me and GB, and GB is Glenn Buxton. So me and GB, we ain't never going to confess. We cheated on the math test, carved some dirty words in our desk, and now it's time for recess. That's almost like a good Tombstone thing, I think. It's a little long, but I'm open to it. I might,
as far as epitaphs go, it's not bad.
And maybe that's the eulogy. But I'd be actually pretty fine with Public Animal number 9 on my headstone. That would actually be pretty cool. Tip for you squatties out there, when the man's out there, as Mike said, when those folks were coming up and rapping on your window as a young high schooler, if you'd only had the chance to say, hey, Mr. Blue Legs, because that was the other thing, is that in the song, there's this kind of back and forth between, is Alice singing about being in school? Is Alice singing about being in prison? Is school prison? Is prison school? There's a little bit of that kind of stuff going on. And he refers quite often to, hey, Mr. Blue Legs, which appears to be a law enforcement officer, if I would read the lyrics correctly.
Now, Kelly, were you ever arrested?
I have never been arrested. I've had the opportunity to observe my brother being arrested, but I myself have never been arrested because I'm remarkably lucky.
There you go.
Because the circumstances involved, I could have equally, which is, I caught a break. You know, you take what you can get.
Yeah, yeah.
How about you? Have you had the opportunity to have Mr. Blue Legs give you a drive in the back of his car?
So the next song, yeah, no, I was arrested. I don't have a record, though. I was never processed, so I don't have a record. I was arrested once, though, and it was kind of funny because the weather was really bad, so they asked me to turn myself in because of the bad weather. They didn't want to have to come out. They didn't want to have to come out and pick me up, so did not exactly make me feel safe, like if I was in some sort of danger or something and had to call 911. You know, requiring assistance, I didn't feel super safe. That they were like, we would come and save you, but I mean, it's pretty overcast.
It's kind of windy out right now. So.
Yeah, and to put this in perspective too, like, I don't live in like bumblefuck. Like, I was a mile away from the police station.
self-service police work. That's something.
They called up and they were just like, hey, listen, it's supposed to snow later and it's cold out and everything. So if you could just turn yourself in, it's going to be better for everybody. So I did, but they were nice. They put me in a cell and everything, but they were nice enough to not process me. And ultimately, no charges were pressed against me and I was free to go.
And we're all glad for that. And you didn't call Mr. Blue Legs. That's probably the key.
No, I did not.
Yeah, I'm totally going with, I'll go by public animal number 9, but I do not want to go by, hey, Mr. Blue Legs. Hey, Mr. Blue Legs.
So. Which makes sense. All right, so the last song, or the next to last song, depending on if you count it as one song or two, we have Alma Mater.
Written by Neil Smith, the drummer. And so most of these songs were the Full House Cooper group. My Stars actually was Cooper and Ezrin, which kind of explains the heavy keyboard stuff a little bit, maybe. Alma Mater is one of these really rare ones where you don't get too many kind of only Dennis Dunaway or only Neil Smith. Matter of fact, I think Neil Smith had a singular writing credit on Love It to Death. There haven't been too many, but Alma Mater is credited to him. Staying with the theme, this is a little bit of, it's a melancholy song to a degree. About leaving school and you've developed these friendships, and are they going to sustain now that you're no longer in school together? You get a don't forget the coop or remember the coop at the end of it. It's a kind of a, you know, melancholy is not typically a description you apply to too many Alice Cooper songs, but that would kind of be this one. And it's kind of reflecting back on all the trouble they got in school and all that. It's a good song. I don't mind it, and it comes plays back into the diversity of it, and it kind of makes sense as kind of the wrap up to kind of talk about when you're kind of leaving school. Overall, I like the song. It's definitely kind of a little unanticipated because you're kind of rolling out of Public Animal Number 9, which is Cooper on full adrenaline, to a little more staid song there. What are your thoughts on Alma Mater?
It's an all right song. It's kind of like middle ground for me. I don't really have strong feelings about it one way or the other. Honestly, I didn't remember much of it until I re-listened to it for this particular episode.
Yeah, it makes sense as the kind of wrap up, which makes it slightly confusing that we have a grand finale after Alma Mater, but it kind of brings the narrative to the end, much like during Gutter Cat versus the Jets. This song wraps up and kind of slides right into grand finale, which is mostly an instrumental, revisiting a little bit of our West Side Story Jet stuff again. We get a little bit of that. We get a pow, kind of the West Side Story pow kind of thing, which is something, I guess. I could live without this being on the track list in terms of it. I don't think it moves much forward at this point in time. There's nothing overly kind of special about it. It's not bad, but it's kind of the appendix of this album. It's there. It's fine. If you had to take it out, I'd be fine too.
Yeah, I mean, it really just feels like an extended instrumental that should have been a part of Alma Mater at the end of it, but, you know, in keeping with the more uniform song length and getting the track listing up a little bit, probably from 7 to 9 songs, gets its own track, which it probably, I don't mind it being on there, but probably should not have been its own track.
Fair enough. So that brings us to the rating board, and this gets harder and harder as we get more albums on how to describe this, but I guess what we'll do is talk about where we're going to place it on our list relatively. And so since we both are familiar with our lists, and currently our lists are identical, sitting up at number 1 for both of us, Still Love It to Death, followed by Killer, then Easy Action and Pretty's for You, who are not moving. They have kind of settled into their spot on the bottom of the list. They'll probably remain fairly undisturbed, like river sediment, for the rest of these conversations.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, you know, some ups and downs coming, but I can't imagine anything really unseating either of those at the bottom two spots.
No, I think it would be difficult. And there's one coming down the road that we'll see for me whether I'm going to try and pull off a tie and say that it ties Easy Action. But I think ultimately I just have an attitude about that album and I'll need to be different. But we'll get there when we get there. But this is definitely a good album. One, if you're getting into Alice Cooper, I'd recommend you get. But I wouldn't put it above Killer and certainly not above Love It to Death. So I have this coming into my list at number three.
Once again, we're in complete agreement here. It's a number three for me as well. And I think it's interesting that so far, so we are five albums in now, and so far our lists are identical. So I'm waiting to see where they start to diverge.
I have a hunch, folks, you might want to turn into the next Dallas Cooper episode, because I think this next one's a very intriguing album. Billion Dollar Babies is the next one up, and that's going to be a fun conversation. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that one as well. And that's an album. So like an album like Killer, an album like Billion Dollar Babies is an album that I'm more familiar with without having to refresh myself than I am with Schools Out.
Yeah, I'd say Love It to Death, Killer, Billion Dollar Babies of the Alice Cooper Group stuff get the heaviest rotation for me as well. Then probably Schools Out, Muscle of Love. We'll talk about it when it gets there. It's got moments, but yeah, I had to kind of refresh on this one a little bit myself, because it's just not, oh, this is the one I'm going to listen to today. But you know, I do enjoy it. It's a good album, but it's the third best album so far.
It's really, it has one great song, one big anthemic hit, and some solid rock and roll songs on it.
Yeah.
It's just not as adventurous as the previous two records in a way that's slightly detrimental to it, because that's what made those records a little bit stronger to me.
Very cool. Well, we will continue on our Merry Squat Cobbler way in rotation with Nurture and Support. Probably keep bouncing back and forth between doing recommendation shows and Alice Cooper reviews. Next up will be Billion Dollar Babies, so looking forward to that. Enjoyed the conversation, Mike. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thank you, guys.
You are the only censor. If you don't like what I say, you have a choice. You can turn me off.
I love the Monster Dog songs.